You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Arthur Miller and David Simon, each a genuine American tragedian, saw in the world a clash of powers, jealous gods one and all, each of which would crush an ordinary human being if she decided to stand in the way of institutional incentive structures, the will of a fickle public, the military-industrial complex, or a dozen other such forces. But theirs is not the only way to bring tragedy out of the classroom and into the public. Brian Dorries, with his projects Theater of War and Outside the Wire, has brought not only the genre tragedy, but particular Athenian tragedies to bear on late modern military life, prison politics, and end-of-life medicine in ways that fascinate me as a professor of literature and should give you, listeners, some food for thought as well. Because of that, and because he agreed to come on after my technological debacle the last time he was on the show, Christianist Profiles is more than glad to welcome him back on the show to talk about his recent book, Theater of War. Thanks for coming back, Brian.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nathan. Appreciate it.
Well, the Theater of War begins with some stories from your own Kenyan days. So that we can make all the humanities professors envious here at the outset, tell our listeners the story of your seeking out Dr. Coleman for the sake of learning Hebrew, and then tell us what you mean when you write, quote, "The secret of reading is to close the book," close quote.
Sure. So when I was a student at Kenyon College, I signed up my first week to study intensive ancient Greek, and that class met five times a week and became an all-consuming life choice. I would even say sort of a core value, and changed my life. And over the span of that year, getting deep into Greek morphology and declensions, and beginning to, I think, come into contact with the thinking behind Greek itself, I started to branch out in all kinds of ways, ways I would never have expected before I set out on that journey. And one of them was that I decided that I wanted to learn Hebrew. I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, I wanted to read portions of the Old Testament. I knew that Hebrew was part of the classical pod that one would, in the 19th century, learn Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. And I set out to find a professor who would teach me Hebrew at the beginning of my sophomore year. And at the time at Kenyon, the only professor who was even in a position to teach me Hebrew on campus was deep into a book project and couldn't take me on as a student. And I, in frustration, searched around the campus for potentially a synagogue or someplace where I might just get some rudimentary training and then work through a grammar myself. Wasn't able to find anyone. I investigated, recorded instruction and books on, Hebrew on tape. At the time it was 1999. Mm-hmm. And ultimately got very frustrated and almost gave up when I got a call back from the religion professor I had originally approached. Her name was Miriam Dinoting. And she said, well, there is one other potential option, but I'm not sure if it's going to work out for you, but I wanted to raise it for you. Yeah, there's an emeritus professor named Dr. Eugen Kuhlmann, who retired in the 80s, who was a legendary intellectual figure here at Kenyon College. He was her principal professor in the 70s and had taught many, many classics and religion majors over the years, and had studied in the German gymnasium system and done his graduate work in Basel, and was rumored to know more than 20 languages, and had studied under Martin Buber and many others. Used to attend courses of Carl Gustav Jung, and was one of the closest friends of Hermann Hesse, and was just a towering figure in the life of the campus, and had since retired and had a stroke and was very exacting about any potential student he might take on. He hadn't taken one on in years. So she set up an interview for me to go down and meet Dr. Kuhlmann, and I went down and sat through a 45-minute interview at his home about a mile from campus, in the middle of essentially a cornfield. And he berated me for about 30 of those 45 minutes, saying in his thick German accent, you know, in the olden days, we had the Latin in what you call elementary school, the Greek in what you call middle school, and the Hebrew, if we were good students of classics, in what you call the high school. You have had a year of Greek and very little Latin and no Hebrew. What makes you think you should come on? I should take you on as my student. And I remember sweating through the sleeves of my Harris Tweed jacket. And as I listened to his reverse commercialism, this is a rhetorical, German rhetorical technique of sort of convincing me, I think, to step up to the challenge. Because at the end of this long monologue, he finally turned to me and said, but if you are willing to undertake the hardships we will take on together, I would be delighted to have one last student. And so I, for essentially 3 years, both during the academic calendar year and during the summers, I would go to Dr. Kuhlman's house multiple times a week. And I studied Greek, Latin, Hebrew, Aramaic, and German with him and learned to read slowly, more slowly, exegetically, etymologically, moving from, once I got a handle on the Hebrew, the Biblia Hebraica to the Septuaginta, Greek translation of the Bible, to the Latin Vulgata, to the German Luther Bible. And, you know, a day with Dr. Kuhlman would mean starting with a discussion of the news, the New York Times, which was a prerequisite for studying with him, and then reading 5 lines in 5 hours across 4 or 5 different versions or translations, chasing etymologies, looking up critical history, and looking through concordances to deepen our appreciation of each line. And that was where my real education took place.
Sounds like it.
It was a transformative experience. It was the kind of experience I think is rare in this world, outside of a religious institution. And even so, there are so few people left of the level of European 19th century erudition that Dr. Kuhlman had possessed, that that kind of encounter is just very rare in our world altogether. So I had the privilege of studying with Kuhlman, and over those 3.5 years, charted a course to one day becoming a philologist, a classicist, but then toward the end of my study with him, as I started to direct my own translations of Greek plays, veered in a new direction. And that's what led me to the path I've been on ever since.
Mm-hmm. Now, you attribute that line, "The secret of reading is to close the book," to Kuhlman himself. How does that mentality fit in with that very careful philological approach that you've just been narrating?
Yeah, well, so Kuhlman would say, after working intensively, I mean, sometimes I would show up at Dr. Kuhlman's house and he would be asleep, and I would wake him up from slumber in his bedroom. He would be expecting me, but he was 84, 85 at the time, so like all people that age, he would sleep. And I woke him up and he would turn to me and he would say, "There is a Hebrew poem on the kitchen table. The book is open to the poem. I just dreamt about it and I saw an error in the poem. See if you can find the error." So he would dream texts, and he only published a couple of essays in his entire life. He was adamantly against publishing. He used to warn me never to publish. Obviously, I didn't heed his warning, but one would always come to regret whatever one wrote. And people, one person that has studied under him characterized Dr. Kuhlman as not a person who wrote texts, but someone who embodied texts, a text person, not a textbook or a text writer. And so at the end of a especially challenging lesson, he would repeat this all the time. He would say, after we'd been working for some time, "What is the secret to reading, Dr. Brian?" He called me Dr. Brian. And I would say, I don't know. And he said, he would always say, to close the book. And then he would turn and say, in the olden days, we would read something while sitting under a tree, and then we would close the book, and we would ask ourselves, what have I just read? And then we might smoke a cigarette or a pipe. But you do not smoke, do you, Dr. Bryan? And so our dialogue would go, and he was playfully teaching, I think, that real learning takes place when you've actually put the books away. Whether you're dreaming the texts, you're embodying them, or you're exploring them experientially through your life. And that was one of the reasons that the New York Times was a prerequisite for studying with him, because we always, no matter how arcane the study was for the day, no matter what we were pursuing, a preposition, it could be, a mistake in the calligraphy of how the work had been originally transcribed in the edition we were reading, we always had to find a way to relate what we were doing to what was happening in the world. And that was also a major bridge to what I'm doing right now. Closing the book meant making the connection between life and text. And then for me, when I started directing my own translations, I realized that in some ways, no one gets closer to text, of performed texts like plays, than directors and actors working on a production. Mm-hmm. And so I started to see the job of the translator of Greek plays or of plays that are to be performed as something that could not be done behind a desk in front of a pile of books, that it had to be done with a group of people collaboratively making decisions that involved the movement of bodies through space, light, sound, music, diction, thought, that if we were going to translate the impulses behind the Greek play and find a way to give them life in the contemporary world, we had to close the book and reinvent the Greeks for ourselves.
Very good. Well, I want to proceed in good Homeric fashion, so we will hear more stories from earlier in the narrative later in the text. But right now, I want listeners to remember 2007. The scandal in the news, the Washington Post breaks this story, is the neglect of veterans at Walter Reed Military Hospital. What about that story turned you towards the project that would eventually become Outside the Wire and Theater of War?
Yeah, thanks. I should qualify that Theater of War is a project. Outside the Wire is actually my company.
Okay, okay.
And Outside the Wire has 14 projects right now. As of today, Theater of War is one of those 14 projects.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
We have some brand confusion because they're both military terms. But
yes.
So totally understandable. In 2007, the Walter Reed scandal broke. I'd already been directing my translations in hospital settings. I'd already been on this path to discovering that if I put my translation Greek plays in front of audiences who'd lived the experiences those plays describe or had some skin in the game in terms of what was being said on stage, that something really powerful would happen, that really important discussions could be catalyzed, and that I could learn from audiences things I didn't know about the text and about the plays and about life. So I'd already discovered that, and I was totally turned on to that and looking for new audiences to explore that with when the scandal broke in the Washington Post in 2007. And, for those of you who may or may not remember, the story of the Walter Reed scandal was basically the story of veterans returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to our nation's flagship medical military facility, Army facility, to substandard care. Because the doctors, were neglectful, but because we had under-resourced the military medical establishment, that we had the audacity, the temerity, some would say the stupidity to send these young men and women over to Iraq and Afghanistan And yet we were not invested in their return and how we'd care for them. And we weren't ready. And I was against the war. I'd marched in the streets in New York. I shook my fist. I shouted in the face of police. I mean, I remember being so outraged and about the foreign policy decision that resulted in these wars. But something about the Walter Reed scandal touched me as, you know, a socially liberal person living in New York City, far removed from the conflicts, who didn't know a single person in the military. And that was a sense I simply couldn't sit on my hands or espouse a position of moral superiority to those who'd fought. I couldn't sit by idly and be complicit in a system that would send them to war and not take care of them when they came back. That we couldn't make the same mistakes we made the Vietnam generation. And so I just got it in my head that if I could simply bring these ancient Greek plays that seem so similar thematically to what I was reading about in the paper, patients abandoned by their own friends, their nation, waiting for treatment on islands like Sophocles' Philoctetes, the play I started with, a play about a veteran who's abandoned on an island by his own friends for 9 years on account of a chronic illness he contracts on the way to the war, or veterans, which I was reading about in the paper at the same time in 2007, 2008, who are returning from the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, with invisible wounds, we now call PTS, and moral injury. And I saw in those stories the story of Sophocles' Ajax, a play about a combat veteran who loses his best friend in the 9th year of the Trojan War and comes unglued and feels betrayed by his commanding officers and ultimately, after shaming himself, takes his own life on stage. And I just got this idea if I could take these plays that seem like they could be ripped from the headlines of the newspapers in 2007 and 2008 and put them in front of these military audiences who'd lived the experiences they described, something powerful, something healing might happen. People might see that they weren't the first to have felt these things, mm-hmm. and that might create the opportunity for people to pursue paths of healing and of, you know, community building. So that was the basic impetus. I mean, at the time, I didn't know a single person in the military. I didn't know how to talk to people in the military. I had no idea how to go about doing it. And it took me about a year and a half of knocking on doors and some of them being politely shut in my face and some of them being slammed and learning just from my own mistakes how to go about approaching the military authentically without a sense of judgment in a way that they would open themselves to this possibility, to this. And that just happened at the end of the day to be the right person standing at the right moment, right? And, you know, in the right place with the right project, because in 2008, when I first got my start with the military, the first theater of war performance, you know, the Congress had appropriated a lot of money to address the Walter Reed scandal, but also the wave of people returning with post-traumatic stress and other invisible injuries. And they were looking for out-of-the-box solutions because, you know, the one solution, the one therapy that could be offered was exposure therapy, which is a cognitive behavioral therapy, which is requires people to narrate their trauma and often takes more than 20 sessions before it works and only works, as far as I understand, for 50% of the people who get to that place. And you're dealing with the military with a talk-averse population. You're dealing, you know, with a stoic population. You're dealing with, at the time we got started, it was a career-ending gesture for most people in their minds to raise their hands and say that they were struggling with an invisible wound.
Right, right.
So there we were with this, you know, this kind of crazy sounding, out of left field proposal to do performances of Greek tragedies for service members as a way of opening up discussion. But if you think about it in the grand scheme of things, you know, it was just one of many alternative possibilities, modalities. You know, over that period that we started working with the military, they got heavily invested in mindfulness training, equestrian therapy, Zen rock gardens, you know, all kinds of psychophysical work that doesn't require narration and a talk therapy. And so, you know, in that, within that, you know, spectrum of things, Greek tragedy doesn't seem that far out of field.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about one production in particular. You talked about Ajax last time you were on the show, but for our listeners who are just coming to this for the first time, how does a theater of war Ajax differ from what they might experience in a first year of college intro to literature class?
Well, I think, you know, the central tenet of our work is the biggest question we're asking.
Mm-hmm.
Is for whom are we telling the story? And whose stories are these? Who has the proprietary interest or rights to tell us what these stories really signify? And I think one of the issues with college and university level study of these plays is that people don't really have skin in the game. You know, Nietzsche and his wry polemic against 19th century classicism, you know, essentially asserts that the young person is not of an appropriate age to actually study antiquity, because one of the prerequisites of studying antiquity and understanding it and relating to it is life experience. And I tend to agree that until you find the way in to what these plays are actually saying to us now, and why the words on the page that seem so distant to most actually are of life and death significance to some living today, then it's all sort of academic and theoretical. So when you come to a theater of war performance, we've answered the question for whom, because the first thing we're trying to do is to bring these plays to an audience for whom the plays actually are of great significance. And I would say for many theater of war performances, whether people live or die can be predicated on listening and responding to the play. And we've had suicides averted. People come forward and say they've gone to therapy for the first time. They've talked to their spouses for the first time. We've had acts of violence averted, where people come forward talking about plotting against their friends because of, you know, disputes and anger. We've had people come up and said they checked themselves into 28-day treatment programs for alcohol and substance abuse after seeing the plays and beginning to open up about it. These are plays that have real life stakes for real people. And so when we put the play in front of an audience that has skin in the game, all kinds of really exciting things happen. So Theater of War and all of our other projects are all readings, but they're not readings in the sort of typical sense of a monotonous reading from a play. There are readings on steroids in which people are, you know, screaming and projectile crying and vocal cords are being ripped. And it has to, you know, the actors, many of whom are well known, are in their street clothes. They're not dressed up fancy. They look like themselves, and there are no costumes, no props. And it's three or four actors sitting at a table bringing to bear all of their talents to bring these ancient plays to life. As sound, just as sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as they're done, we bring up three members of the audience, and they're not doing the entire play. Those actors are doing probably, you know, 30 or 40% of the play, a selection of scenes that we know will elicit a series of responses from the audience. So as soon as they're done, the actors go immediately into the audience, and they sit down, and we bring up and replace the actors with four members of the community who are not power brokers, they're not politicians, they're not on book tour, they're not academics, they're just real people who've lived the experiences in some way or been touched by the experiences described by the play. So in the instance of Ajax, we bring up a military spouse, a combat veteran who's done multiple deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, a Vietnam veteran usually, or a veteran of a previous war, and then a mental health professional who works directly with this population. And they speak for 3 to 4 minutes max about, you know, exactly what in the play as they just heard it connected with them, and they're asked not to prepare remarks. And sometimes the best panelists are people who have very little to say, but come to it earnestly and emotionally, and in effect, model for the audience a way of responding that is sincere and from the heart. And as soon as they're done with their brief opening remarks, then I go out into the audience and I ask the audience questions. Why do you think Sophocles wrote this play and staged it for his community in a century in which the Athenians saw nearly 80 years of war, an audience that would have been comprised of, you know, tens of thousands of combat veterans? What was he trying to say? What was his objective? And of course, the answers vary, because theater of war is not about didacticism. It's not about teaching. If anything, the central tenet of the work is that the audience is there to teach us, not the other way around. And it's really about the opening up of meeting. So my job as facilitator, as I go out into the audience, is to try to find a way to validate everything that gets said, no matter how repugnant I might find some of it to be, so that we can allow the audience to respond as a group, and the members of the audience to respond to one another without editorializing our, you know, our feelings about what's being said.
Mm-hmm. One of those stories, and I'll just tell our listeners, it might seem like I'm strip mining this book of all of its good stories, but I'm just skimming the surface. One of the stories is of a combat veteran named Jeff, who had experienced the feeling of being, and I'll quote his words here, on trial for engaging in combat the way that his training had led him to engage in combat. What about Sophocles helped him in particular and his family deal with the experience of that betrayal that he was feeling?
Yeah, so Jeff Hall, Major Jeff Hall at the time, was a combat veteran from Iraq, who was still in uniform when he first saw Theater of War. He and his wife were asked to be panelists at an early performance in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And when they were told about the exercise, they were a little skeptical. Most of our audiences are quite skeptical, which is always good because they have much further to travel in terms of their transformation. Mm-hmm. He and his wife went out and they bought a copy of Sophocles' plays. They tried to read it and they couldn't get through the first five pages. And they thought, well, we're just going to wing it. And as he describes, they got to the performance, they were listening, and as the actor Bill Camp, who was playing Ajax, who's in our trailer, which you can look up online, who, you know, laid into the rage of this character Ajax, who feels he's been betrayed and devalued by the people above him, and his eyes turn black with hatred, and his face turns red, veins are popping out of his neck, and he's screaming about the vengeance that he wishes to enact on those who betrayed him, and his feeling of isolation and worthlessness. Jeff remembers turning to Sherry, his wife, and saying, well, she said to him first, I think, that's you. And he said, that's right, that's me. And afterwards, after they candidly reflected in front of the audience about how this play wasn't high poetry for them, it was kitchen sink realism. No matter how extreme the performance, it was they had experienced it at that level. And so and one of the things I learned from them right off the bat was that, in fact, if I had one word to define this work, it's permission. By going to this extreme, by committing to the emotions demanded by these ancient texts, we're in effect giving the audience permission to acknowledge that they've felt these things, they've said these things, and they can meet us halfway or they can go all the way because the actors have already gone there. Jeff and Sherry became regular panelists for us for a while, and we became close friends and got to know their children. And in fact, one of their children, after multiple performances of listening to her parents after Theater of War performances open up and tell their story, called me and said that she thought that Theater of War had saved their family, which for me was, you know, unimaginable that a play could have that kind of an impact. Anything I would do would have that kind of an impact on anyone. And Jeff's main issue, as he sort of worked through it over many performances, wasn't the PTS or the traumatic brain injury that he sustained from the IED attacks that he had lived through, or the loss of the men that he had reported to, the guys that had died under his command. Those things haunted him and those things affected him. The thing that cut the deepest for him and the thing he related most to in the story of Ajax was an overwhelming sense of betrayal. And betrayal is something we're talking about a lot these days because Jonathan Shea, the MacArthur Award-winning psychiatrist, and many others now in the classics and psychology and psychiatry field are talking about how PTSD doesn't fully or adequately describe the range of emotions and feelings and crises that people who've experienced trauma often feel. And that another helpful way of thinking about what happens, especially in combat, is moral injury.
Mm-hmm.
And moral injury is defined by Jonathan Shea as the betrayal of what's right, usually in a high-stakes situation in which you have very little control. I did bad things, I saw bad things, I was complicit in something that went against my moral compass. And when Jeff got over to Iraq and he trained to fight a certain way and to protect his men a certain way, he soon after, the fall of Baghdad, was trying to prosecute the war in the way he'd been trained. And it was the exact moment when counterinsurgency strategy COIN was, being implemented, and he found himself completely at odds with his command. Instead of being able to fight by displaying overwhelming force against anyone who would attack them, they were having to account for every bullet they shot. And they were being left in situations where they were being attacked or they were drawing out attacks in which they weren't able to retaliate or protect themselves, at least from his perspective. And I want to acknowledge that this is not me narrating it. This is based on Jeff's perception. And so when he saw the play Ajax and he saw this character from 2,500 years ago, who's, a major character in the Trojan War, whose downfall is really precipitated not by the 9 years of fighting, not by the men he's lost or the exhaustion, not simply by the grief of the loss of his best friend Achilles, but really the straw that breaks his back is a sense of being devalued and betrayed when his commanding officers, superiors, pass him over for the honor of Achilles' armor. And this betrayal, whether it's real or not, whether we all agree it's a betrayal, Ajax perceives as a betrayal, and it rearranges his sense of left and right, north and south, right and wrong. And he struggles with that betrayal until he commits suicide on stage. And then his body is left on stage for the second half of the play. And I get the sense that Sophocles is asking us to think about, not just as leaders, but as citizens, look at how betrayal can poison a community. Look at how betrayal can poison a family. Look at how betrayal can poison an individual. Look at how an individual can ultimately betray himself because of a perceived betrayal. And so while there have been many advancements in the treatment of trauma and PTS over the last 25 years, the moral and the spiritual dimensions of the experience of war and trauma are still not being adequately addressed. And so there's something about these ancient plays and the theme of betrayal that sort of permeates them all that speaks to this other part of the war experience and touches veterans and their families in a way that I think very few other things do, and then opens up the possibility of having this really healing dialogue about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, hearing you narrate this notion of moral injury, it strikes me that the psychology majors whom I teach, and I'll admit that's about as much regular contact I have with the counseling profession, one of the central dogmas that they are always repeating to me is that moral judgment cannot be part of what they do.
Yeah.
And yet it seems to be at the core of what tragedy is doing and what you are doing. You work with counselors a lot more than I am familiar with counselors. Is that a dogma that you have encountered as well, and do they resist your project on account of it?
I think in the early days they resisted the project because it was just so extreme. And uh-huh. they were worried that we would re-traumatize people.
Yeah.
And I never have become cavalier about the fact that we don't, but we've been in front of 70,000 service members and veterans at this point. We haven't really seen an extreme adverse reaction during that time. What I see in our audience is a palpable sense of relief to discover that they're not alone in having thought and felt these things, even if they're activated by how intense the performances are, even if they're rattled. So psychologists, psychiatrists were a bit hesitant in the beginning because of that. But then we moved full throttle with the DOD's funding and help to do 100 performances in 1 year. And we had the backing of, you know, the top psychologists and psychiatrists in the military at that time, and also, you know, have garnered the support of those in the civilian world. I think, you know, we don't propose theater of war to be therapy. I want to make that really clear.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
No, but I think most psychologists and I see it as a door, and whether people walk through it is their choice, and it's not for everyone. But my hope is, and our hope is, that when people walk through that door, they walk toward various paths of healing, which definitely include mental health professionals and counseling. They also include all kinds of other things. One of the central tenets of theater of war that I think is important, I think theater of war can be seen as therapeutic. The Greeks model for us a way of healing that's based on community. And I think we've lost touch with, especially in the secular world, even having the space to come together and acknowledge the darkness of our humanity in this way, and to face the challenges of what's brought back from traumatic experiences, whether it's war or the refugee crisis or, you know, you name it, not as individuals, but as part of a larger community, as part of a democracy. And so I think there's healing to be done through this model, this communalizing model. And there's so many other ways of doing this. Theater of War is just one of them. I think most psychologists and psychiatrists see, and social workers see, theater of war as something that's, you know, that augments the work that they're doing. And in fact, really at its core, I see theater of war as a public health campaign that destigmatizes talking about it and sharing stories about these very taboo subjects, getting people out of the shadows and out of the closets and out into the center of their community, and helping them to feel validated and supported by people whose experiences are not radically dissimilar from theirs. So I think most mental health professionals see that as powerful and healing, and once they get a sense for our objectives. But what I was saying earlier about moral injury is that, you know, we think of trauma in these very clinical terms, and we think of it by virtue of its symptomology, like it's a neurophysiological response. You know, it's a normative and totally natural physical reaction to abnormal circumstances, and that certainly explains a large amount of the trauma that people coming back from war manifest in their bodies. But what Sophocles plays are speaking to, and the Homeric epics, and Jonathan Shea in his book Achilles in Vietnam so beautifully articulates, is that the wound that cuts the deepest may not be this neurophysiological unbalancing that takes place when we experience death and trauma. It may be experiencing betrayal in the context of these high stakes life and death situations. Those types of betrayals in those high stakes situations tend to haunt us for the rest of our lives. And so the plays, both plays that we perform, speak directly to that, bring it out of the shadows, and create a vocabulary to help people who've experienced those betrayals articulate their feelings about it. And the reason why we have 14 projects, and they're all in various settings, prisons, you know, addiction clinics, hospice facilities, hospitals, is that anyone who's worked in a complex hierarchy, especially one that deals with life and death questions or issues, has, I think, been betrayed probably at some point or another by someone above or below or both. And so part of being functional and being able to help other people is to acknowledge that. And the plays do that.
All right. Well, I want to turn to the prison setting that you just now mentioned. Your chapter on... Well, actually, I mean, let's start with the analogy between the military and the prison context. One of the things that you named earlier is a sense of permission that your productions give the soldiers and the sailors and the airmen. What kind of permission do American penitentiary workers need that Aeschylus seems to give them?
Yeah, so after Theater of War, about the same time Theater of War started to take off, I got this note, this idea that this play by, or attributed to Aeschylus, may or not have been may or may not have been written by Aeschylus, called Prometheus Bound,
mm-hmm.
A play about this god who gives fire to man and becomes the most iconic martyr and prisoner of sort of the ancient world, BC. That this play would speak to those in corrections. Now, at the time, I thought, you know, I was going to take it to the inmates. But as I started to try to talk with corrections professionals about their jobs, it became pretty clear the closest analog to the military in our culture, one of the closest analog, was the corrections worker. A similar hierarchy. They dealt with life and death ethical questions all the time and violence. They could be punished for any number of things they did or didn't do. And adding one more level of difficulty for them, in the eyes of the general population, they're essentially criminalized along with the criminal population that they guard or they serve. And that really there isn't there have been very few portrayals of people who work in corrections in the media that are anything but, you know, the cliches of corrupt people, corrupted by their power and by the roles they play, you know, doing offensive things. So I soon discovered that this community was even more circumscribed, even more isolated than the military, because they had, you know, at least the military at this point, for the most part, is something that we all, you know, in principle support, and those who fought, you know, we may not support the foreign policy that they prosecuted, but we support the people who volunteer to go over and do it. That's not, couldn't be said about those in corrections. And So here's this play, Prometheus Bound. It's not really about what Prometheus did to get locked up by Zeus at the end of the earth in Scythia in the Caucasus Mountains. It's about what happens once he's locked up. And he, you know, over the span of the play, he becomes more and more recalcitrant and sort of rebellious. And ultimately, by the end of the play, from my perspective, he is trying to provoke a response in his captors that will be so punitive and so negative that it will assert his moral superiority over them. He'll become a martyr. And he'll triumph over his captors by whatever level of punishment they bring against him. And so I got this idea, if I could put it in front of corrections officers who deal with recalcitrant and angry prisoners every day and then have to make decisions about, ethical decisions about how they respond, that a powerful conversation could occur. And the first place we did it was in the Supermax complex in Jefferson City, Missouri. And then that led us to come back to Missouri and do it in a female facility where we had Prometheus played by a woman. And then that led, after another performance at a big corrections conference, that led us ultimately to do it in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for the guards and the detention ops in the camps, and for FBI and CIA and, you know, all the rest, interpreters, psychologists, psychiatrists, Marines, which in some ways was the apotheosis of the project, because I could never have conceived that we end up doing it at Gitmo when we started it.
Mm-hmm.
but it led us to the most iconic corrections or, you know, prison facility, detention facility in the world. And it required us to sort of live up to everything I've described before, no matter how much we might be against Gitmo or its existence or whatever our political feelings might be. For the sake of seeing this project work, and creating dialogue that wouldn't have existed before in this highly, you know, regimented and challenging setting, we had to come in and listen and open ourselves up to who these people were and what their struggles were. And what we discovered, of course, was that very few people who worked at Gitmo raised their hand and said, I'd like to work at Gitmo.
Yeah.
And a lot of them would prefer not to be working at Gitmo. And most of them, in fact, as we discovered. And many of them couldn't even talk with their families or with other people in the military, so stigmatized that they were there. So when we got to the discussion about, well, who's Prometheus? Have you seen him? Have you met him? Many people raised their hands who worked in the camps and said, well, I'm Prometheus. I'm the one who's chained to this rock at the end of the earth doing what I never wanted to do. Completely judged and completely isolated, and who could be punished at any moment for some ethical slip that I may or may not understand at the time that I'm doing it. And, when I asked, well, have you worked with Prometheus? A guard stood up, and he, a young guy with very little training, who had been thrust into these camps, described being attacked by one of the detainees. And attacked with multiple bodily fluids and attacked by having his family threatened back home and not being able to retaliate and having to, you know, operate according to, Geneva conventions and try to maintain his cool. And he talked about how hard that was. And people were very forthright about the challenge of being in that setting and trying to do the right thing and the rules of engagement and how confusing it all was. And then ultimately, at the end of the discussion, I asked, well, who wins at the end of this play when Prometheus provokes in his captors this punishment where, you know, ultimately, his, as I'm sure you know, his liver is eaten by, an eagle every day, and his skin is burned by the sun and is frozen by at night. And he becomes this martyr known for all time for innocent suffering. And some would even say a proto-Christian figure, if you're looking for intimations of Christianity in the ancient world. And before I could finish asking the question, the JAG lawyer stood up and he said, well, I'm glad you asked that because we've lost all moral authority, this military lawyer said, in these wars until we give these detainees due process and fair. Mm-hmm. And in the front row was a four-star general who commanded the Southern Hemisphere and the admiral who was the commanding officer of Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, there were people who were speaking their personal truths. And there was, I challenged, there probably wasn't any other open forum or setting at Gitmo where that could occur. And yet no one was going to be punished for their opinions. No one was going to be, you know, demoted because they said what they said, because at the end of the day, they were responding to an ancient play. And I think that's really critical, you know, that there's something about this work where we perform these ancient texts for contemporary audiences, that if we do it right, the hierarchy temporarily dissolves in this kind of Dionysian way, that the boundaries between us for a brief 45-minute period to an hour begin to fall away.
Mm-hmm. What strikes me interesting, too, is that not only the military hierarchy, as you're describing it, but also what I think of as a pervasive political climate in America seems to dissipate when you do your production. So in other words, as you've already, you know, hinted at, the Guantanamo Bay Guard is someone who is, shunned. He is a non-person in a lot of political discourse. He is simply an epiphenomenon of, you know, governmental abuse of power and so on and so forth. It seems like there's a moral complexity to these events that often falls away not only in the military but even in political talk. I mean, do you see that going on in your productions as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've learned from this work is if you want to have a conversation about something that divides us in this highly charged, highly cynical political environment, and it's about a subject in which someone's going to suffer or even die, Don't start the conversation with people entrenched in their ideological positions shouting at each other, which characterizes, I think, American discourse at this point, especially right this week.
Oh, yeah.
Start with a portrayal of human suffering first, and then have the conversation. And what happens is, I mean, this is what Plato was, you know, or Socrates in Plato's Republic was fearful of, that this is why the poets and the dramatists in particular were exiled or drummed out of his ideal republic, because he feared that they would sway people to do things they wouldn't do otherwise. But I challenge that, in fact, it's possible to have a highly grounded ethical conversation while still being connected to one's heart and guts. And that's what these plays do. They keep us in our head. They keep us from just slipping directly into our heads and into our ideological positions, and remind us that we're talking about human lives and human beings. And the plays are structured in such a way, especially Sophocles' plays, where you can see every character's perspective. Everyone believes they're right, he or she is right, and someone is going to die, someone's going to be sacrificed, and, you know, from a mistake usually that's made in ignorance. Not complete ignorance, because Greek plays aren't about people suffering completely innocently, but in a certain gray zone where if they had more information than they were given, they certainly wouldn't have done what they did. And that, to me, I think, helps remind audiences that we're kind of all in that place, that if we had all the pieces of the puzzle, we wouldn't continue to make such ginormous mistakes. But we're all fallible, and we're all capable of these mistakes. And so we need to exercise humility in our discourse and be reminded by these stories that, you know, human lives are at stake, and suffering will occur based on what we say and what we do. And whether suffering is alleviated or not, you know, I would challenge after our performances, is wholly predicated on what people do when they leave and they go back out into the world. So, I mean, look, I don't think it's realistic to say political discourse in America needs to be, you know, coupled with performances of Greek tragedies, but there's something to be learned from Greek tragedy as this artistic form that developed concurrently with Athenian democracy, that rose and fell essentially with the model of Athenian democracy, about how we as citizens come together as a community and have conversations that are grounded both in ethics and rhetoric and legal positions, which Greek plays are full of, but also in empathy and shared discomfort, in our guts and in our hearts. And that's the goal of what we do. I think the more we do it, the more I see its potential applications to subjects that we haven't come to quite yet because they're kind of politically daunting on the horizon, like gun control and climate change and abortion, that we're going to move into those areas because I think those areas need an intervention to break the loggerhead of the kind of vitriolic discourse that people are engaged around them. And I think the plays can help us get to a place where we can hear others' perspectives by way of the ancient stories.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and disclose now what I didn't disclose when we first talked 2 years ago. Joplin, Missouri, where your company put on a translation of the Bible, Book of Job, is the home of one of my own church traditions, Bible colleges. And the church at which you performed is a church within my own tradition. So, since this is Christian Humanist Profiles, how is producing and performing biblical drama distinct from what you do with Athenian tragedies?
Yeah, I don't really see it as radically different because, I mean, I suppose if there were other texts we were performing than the one we did, it might be different. But the Book of Job is structured like a Greek tragedy. People have pointed this out. It has a prologue, an epilogue. It has episodes. It's poetry. It takes up as its central question human suffering, and I think more important to the discussions that we facilitate, how humans behave in light of their suffering. So, I mean, with very modest adaptation into a theatrical form, we took Stephen Mitchell's translation, which is a performative translation of of the Book of Job. And as you said, we performed it at College Heights Christian Church in Joplin, Missouri, for 2,000 or more congregants, not just from that church, but from the community, on the eve of the one-year anniversary of the tornado, the EF5 tornado that took so many lives and destroyed so many homes in 32 minutes. And I guess the one thing that's a little bit different is one of the key elements of our work is distance. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to create a safe place for audiences by using either cultural or temporal distance. So we're not saying to them, this is you. It's not documentary theater. We're asking audiences to reflect, well, what do you see of yourself in this distant, this ancient story? And so we're always trying to find something like with the theater of war, the warrior ethos, you know, the archetype of the warrior is what transcends time. You know, people connect with it who are in the military. With the Book of Job, the hope was that this biblical figure who may or may not, but somehow fits into the larger Judeo-Christian tradition, would plug into the value set of the people of Joplin, but still be distant enough by way of the Old Testament that people wouldn't feel accused of anything.
And also the fact that so few people actually read Job, frankly.
Yes, people no longer read. I mean, I think probably in the last 50 to 80 years, people have stopped reading it as much. But it's a text that, you know, timelessly explores the same set of questions. It's nice that we transition from Prometheus to Job because there are lines in both that are actually identical. In the case of Prometheus, it's a god calling out for the world to witness the injustice of his suffering. And in the Book of Job, it's a human. But the words are very similar because I think there's a zeitgeist moving through the ancient world, you know, roughly the 6th or 5th or 4th century, in that period where BC, where people are asking these really fundamental questions about human suffering. And they're questions that we still haven't answered, but they're questions that are really important to continue to litigate and to ask. But with the Book of Job, the objective, which we performed that project in Joplin, then we performed it all over New York City after Hurricane Sandy. We performed it in Mississippi on the 10-year anniversary of Katrina down the Gulf. We performed it in Japan for the Fukushima survivors. And, you know, we have very uniform responses that we hear from people. One of the biggest issues with these natural disasters and the indiscriminate nature of the destruction they leave in their wake is that there seems to be no moral causality, right? I mean, regardless of your faith, I feel that most of us in our hearts walk around at least hoping that the world is constructed in a way where innocent people are not made to suffer, that, you know, that people who do terrible things aren't rewarded. And yet the indiscriminate nature of the destruction of a natural disaster where one block can be destroyed and the other block can be wholly untouched raises the same set of questions that are at the center of the Book of Job. In his monologue, his, you know, screed, his, you know, his vitriolic argument. And our objective by doing it isn't to, you know, say that's the right set of questions to be asking or that we should all renounce our faith. It's really just let's acknowledge how uncomfortable this makes us and then search within ourselves and our community for, you know, the answers. And I think at the core, the objective for us in presenting Book of Job in all these settings isn't really a question about faith as much as it is about how do human beings behave in the face of suffering, and more important, how do they behave in the face of other people's suffering, which is also a question that's at the center of all the Greek plays we perform. So that if a performance is, you know, the note that I give actors most regularly, and you can see the Book of Job, you know, there's a documentary about the Book of Job that PopTech made, if you Googled it online, I think it's called Storytelling from the Storm. You can see Paul Giamatti playing Job at that church in Joplin. The note that I give the actors is, and I gave Paul that day, make them wish they'd never come.
Mm-hmm.
And that may sound inappropriate or harsh, but if we create a sense of shared discomfort in the audience that's so palpable that people want to leave in the moments when the suffering portrayed on stage becomes overwhelming, then no matter what our political or ideological beliefs are, or our faith is, we all share that in common, that sense of discomfort. And I think what we're up against in that moment of discomfort is the limits of our own compassion, the limits of our physical ability to be in the presence of suffering. And I think what the story of Job and the story of these Greek plays, Ajax and Philoctetes and the other plays we perform, the core question that's asking us is, you know, if our value is to never leave another human being to suffer or behind, look how hard it is to live up to that value when it comes to these types of experiences, whether it's the invisible wounds of war or natural disaster or things that happen to people that we just can't bear to acknowledge or be in the presence of. Look what it requires of us to be friends, real friends. And so I found that a lot of people came out of the Joplin experience with not just their faith intact, but reconnected and reminded of how the disaster in Joplin brought people together, rather than, you know, reinforcing their differences. And I think out of that comes a sense of resilience and community and cohesion that we don't need to wait for the next natural disaster to achieve, that theater has a role in generating it in communities without the actual suffering taking place.
Okay. Well, I've been asking the questions during most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I want you to have the last word. So whether you want to talk about the section on end-of-life care that I unfortunately didn't get to today, whether you want to talk about theater, trauma, Greek syntax, whatever you want to talk about, go ahead and have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about as we wrap things up today?
Yeah, I mean, I went out on this journey originally thinking that that the objectives of performing these plays around these issues and for these communities was to elicit empathy. And while I think that may be part of it, I'm less and less concerned with empathy as I am now with the idea of shared discomfort, which I was just talking about a second ago. We have an end-of-life project, as you mentioned, where there's a play written by Sophocles called The Women of Trachis, which features a scene in which a dying man, Heracles, the great hero Heracles, who's been poisoned by his wife accidentally, and is suffering tremendously on stage, perhaps more than any character in all of Greek literature, begs his son to be his doctor in the Greek, his iater, by burning him alive, by taking his life, by helping him take his own life. And, you know, I don't want to be duplicitous. This is where it's important that audiences don't feel that we are cramming a political perspective down their throats. You know, I have a political perspective for Theater of War. If there is one, it's simply that PTSD exists, we need to talk about it. Moral injury exists, we need to talk about it. With end-of-life care, it's the same. It's not we need to assist people in suicide or that we need to, you know, to affect major policy change. It's just simply we should be talking about the experience of death and dying and the opportunities for making meaning around that experience with the same level of intensity and resources that we talk about the process of giving birth, which over the last 25 years has become not just an industry, but something that we all have been touched by, which has come out of the closet and out of the shadows and now is, you know, very mainstream. So in this scene, there's a tremendous amount of screaming and wailing and agony on stage. And I often ask audiences, as I mentioned before, why do you think Sophocles wrote this play, and why would he portray such extreme human suffering for so long? What was he trying to achieve? And you hear various responses, but I think every night, but the thing that sticks with me, the response I hear most often is, people describing their own desire to leave, or their own comprehension of why the characters in the play might have abandoned the characters who were suffering. So after an early performance of Theater of War, a general stood up and said in front of a sea of other generals who outranked her, when I asked the question, why did Sophocles write this play, she said, "I think Sophocles wrote this play because he must have been in the minority with regard to the compassion he felt for the individuals in his community that were struggling with these issues he portrayed in his play. I think Sophocles wrote the play to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable." And that's become our motto. I think it's possible through the portrayal of human suffering to both validate what people silently are experiencing and aren't able to articulate in front of each other for fear of alienating themselves even more, and isolating themselves even more. And I think it's possible, while comforting them, to simultaneously unsettle the rest of the audience and make them think about what's required of us to be human beings, to be friends, to be lovers, to be brothers and sisters, and what would it be like if we allowed ourselves to feel what it would be appropriate to feel on our way to work or at the kitchen table? How would we respond if we took our defenses down? And theater has this capacity to take them down for a few seconds. And during that brief moment, we can now then interrogate whether we feel comfortable with the decisions we make on a daily basis. So in closing, I just want to say that, the biggest lesson for me is that tragedy can provoke this dual response, comfort and affliction, and that there is hope to be found in tragedy, not in the plays and not in the stories themselves, but in the audiences that come together to bear witness to the truth of the experiences those ancient stories describe. And so, for those listening who are the dwindling few who have studied or are studying the humanities, I would simply say, without compromising the literary or artistic value of what we do, there's no question in my mind that the humanities can make a difference in the world. And in some ways, we have to learn to close the book before we can figure out how to actually affect that change and that difference, and also make a living doing it. So thanks, Nathan, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brian, for coming on the show. Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in to our conversation. Christian Humanist Profiles is a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I am Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.